This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9. You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan. Big Star. They are the greatest band you've never heard of. They lived fast and died young. They were the inspirations for the likes of R.E.M. and the Flaming Lips. And now they are the subject of a feature-length documentary film called Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. The movie chronicles the dismal commercial failure, subsequent massive critical acclaim, and enduring legacy of pop music's greatest cult phenomenon.
I didn't get to hear much Big Star music because they usually wouldn't write in the studio. When they showed up with the first songs for number one record, they basically had the arrangements completely together the way they wanted to do them. They came in, they set up as a four-piece band in the studio, everybody playing on the basic tracks simultaneously. And that was the first time I was hearing those tunes.
Sitting down to go through Ballad of El Gordo, it seems like we'd run through that song one time, and then the next time it just all clicked and was pretty much realized the way you hear it on the album.
Even just hearing the tracks, the two guitars, the bass, and the drums, I said, you know, if they've got any lyrics that are halfway decent to go with this, we've got some.
I had the chance to speak to Drew DiNicola. He is the director of Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. So, Drew, let me start with the popular vernacular, 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's got to be quite something.
That's true, yeah. I'm proud of that.
So how do you pull off a film about a forgotten band that's even an underdog in the rock world? Tell me where you start.
Where I started was just kind of where everyone would start with a film that's trying to tell the story. But as I tried to tell the story, I realized that everything about this film was going to have to be different from your typical rock and roll documentary. So I just started to realize, like, you know, this band never really had a life as a band. I mean, so what do you really cover? And I mean, they didn't last for very long, and they didn't really have any fans. And, you know, the members kept changing. So there's really not a real story between these guys being buddies, and it's not a buddy story. You know, so it was basically like an anti-rock and roll band story. And so I started reaching for other ideas to sort of tell the story better, and found that, you know, what this band always had in common, no matter how the music changed and the members changed, was the city of Memphis and the recording studio and the sort of loose-knit group of interesting weirdos in Memphis that were, you know, fans of Anglo music and were trying to do something, you know, bigger than what they had going in their town.
I've always thought that it would be far more exciting to do a film about a band like Big Star rather than the Rolling Stones, because there just must be so much gold to be mined, so much that people just don't know about. What was that like for you as a writer-director? Because you're almost, like you said, it's not a buddy movie. You're almost tackling individuals.
Exactly, yeah. And also, like, when you bring up, like, the Rolling Stones, that was the sort of argument that I started making to the people that I was working with, that when we kept saying, like, well, should we learn about Alex's drug problems and his girlfriend and, you know, these various things? If it were Mick Jagger, then you want to know about Jerry Hall or Anita Pallenberg, Keith's girl or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, what was that relationship like? But with this band, for a lot of it, it was like introducing people to who these guys were. And so it was always kind of a challenge to ride the line between making a film for the diehard fans and also trying to introduce new people into this music and into this band's story. So really the sort of line was always, how are we, what elements of the story are explaining the music? And there was just a very lucky situation where there was a poetry there between what was happening to these guys and the city that they were living in and the times that they were changing was always reflected in that music. So that was kind of the way we carried through with this film.
Well, yeah, there's that great line at the beginning of the film from Alexis Taylor where he goes, you have to do a lot of explaining on who this band is.
Yeah, that's funny. You know, all of that stuff at the beginning of the film was the last thing that we did. We'd already been showing the film in festivals and realized that we needed to give people like a bit of a primer before the film started. And in a way, instead of having this like whole, your typical, this band influenced me from all these luminaries, it's kind of like a cliche at this point. I thought, why don't we find musicians who actually know this band and can try to explain it to you. And it was actually like I was having them do what I had to do for years and years when people would say, what's your film about? And say, well, it's about this band. They were never really famous. Have you heard about Chilton? Oh, well, there's a song by The Replacements about him. Do you know that? No, you don't know that. Do you know that 70s show, the theme song? We don't know that song. Do you know the Box Tops, The Letter? Do you know Elliot Smith? Like all of these little like elements that I would have to keep going, and eventually one of them would work, you know. But that's kind of with the Big Star story, like the devil's in the details. It's almost the aggregation of all of these details that makes it interesting. I remember that we debated whether or not we're going to have William Eggleston in the film, but you know, we were in town, we knew his son, and it did work out, you know, in a very weird, you know, left turn kind of a way. But, you know, it's pretty amazing that, like, probably the most important modern photographer of the 20th century that's still living took their second, you know, the second cover, album cover's photo. And that photo is worth, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars if you get an original print. So, you know, that's kind of amazing. And it is related in some weird way. And that was what we were always trying to do.
And you're absolutely right. I came to Big Star via that 70s show, and I think I love that theme song. And then you know how we all have that one friend who knows so much more about music and loves telling you about it. And every time I play that song, he goes, "Well, you know, that's not the original. And the original is by Big Star." And you know, that guitar riff as played by Big Star is just so stripped, and it's just so much more magical for In the Street.
Well, that's the first time I've ever heard anyone say they learned about Big Star through that 70s show. That's interesting. And also interesting is that, you know, on our own dime, we were out of money at this point. You know, through various people at William Morris, we finally got a hold of Cheap Trick and ran down to Florida to, I think it was like an AT&T conference that they were playing for, you know, a lot of bands do this for extra money, and we just wanted to ask them about how they, you know, the whole deal with them doing that song, covering that song, and I just assumed that they were all massive Big Star fans.
Right.
And they were not. and I also just figured, you know, their music, I mean, they're power pop. That's what Cheap Trick is, and Big Star are like the progenitors of that, like, before that term was really thrown around very much. And I just assumed it was like a little school of people that were all in the same stuff. But it wasn't the case. I mean, they had heard of them. They were bigger fans of the Box Tops. And just the guitar, one of the guys, the bass player, was a fan. But the other guys, they didn't know. They had never even heard the song. So it's interesting.
I'm speaking to Drew DiNicola. He is the director of a new documentary, Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. After this, more about the band and their history, but first, a little Big Star. Here they are with I'm In Love With A Girl. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. This is the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Paganampake Pagan, and today I'm speaking to Drew DiNicola. He is the director of the new feature documentary Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. It's about the greatest band you've never heard of. So a lot of Malaysians probably don't know Big Star or their music. They do know and love the folks they've influenced, though, R.E.M., Bell and Sebastian, Flaming Lips. Tell us a little bit about Big Star and why you were drawn to the story. Like, were you a fan long before you made this film, or did your fandom grow as you were making this film?
Well, I was definitely part of the second or third wave of interest in the band that happened in the mid-90s when all of the bands in England, every band on Creation Records, like Teenage Fan Club, Jesus and Mary Chain, Primal Scream, Bon Sebastian, all those bands were making waves in America at the time. And Elliott Smith was on the ascent, and Jeff Buckley, and all that stuff was 90s stuff. And all of those bands were talking about Big Star in unison. They were literally, every time you opened up a Spin magazine or a Rolling Stone magazine, they would be referring to Big Star. In fact, I was felt inundated by Big Star. This is what's so funny about how unpopular they are now. I felt like, no more Big Star. Like, someone was like, you got to hear Big Star. I was like, I don't want to hear him. And then, you know, I came around to them like a year later in college because of the reissue of the third record, which was just so bizarre. That record was how I got into that band. I needed that record to get into that band because it was just so markedly different from the other two. And it was just so bizarre. And that was my college record. That was the record I listened to every day and put on mixtapes for girls. And then I kind of worked my way back to the other two records. I think I appreciated those records because they were formed by that weird trajectory that the band took. I've never heard any band that took that kind of a trajectory from something that was totally listenable to, I mean, maybe you could say the Beatles went from like, She Loves You, Yeah, 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 to number nine, but there were a lot of records in between those two songs.
There was.
So it was Big Star, it was like 2.5 years between, you know, 13 and, you know, Holocaust. And I was just, it just didn't sound like it could even have been the same band. And what was fun about doing the film and what really kind of energized the film was that I started to find strains of what happened with Third in the other records, and that there was always this sort of melancholy and this cynicism in their sort of sunshiny pop that they were doing. And it just makes for very interesting listening because on the surface it is very accessible. But as you listen further, you just hear like these elements of pain and cynicism in a lot of those songs.
And I guess what's particularly fascinating about these guys as we watch them in your film is that they seem genuinely like the kind of people who just want to play that music.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think that we kind of got it out in the story a bit that Memphis is and really was a music city. It's not the music city that it used to be. But at the time, they were sort of the last era of Memphis as a music city. I mean, there were a considerable number of recording studios there and a lot of people making music on their own time. And, you know, there was this idea of being slightly uncompromising that they all kind of shared. But the thing is that being uncompromising used to lead to number one records. You know, that's what all the Sun records were. I mean, they were uncompromising records. You know, and we can go from, you know, Howlin' Wolf to Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis. All of those people were just doing what they did, and they were doing it their way, they were successful at it. And the difference was that Big Star were not, because so much had changed by the early 70s.
That was Drew DeNicola. You can catch his film, Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me, on the Sundance Channel, that's Astro 438, on the 20th and 23rd of December. It's really quite brilliant. Now here's Big Star playing us to the news, Ballad of El Gudo, on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. Good evening, I'm Umar Pagan, Ampike Pagan, and today on the Evening Edition we're talking about Alex Chilton, Chris Bell, Jody Stevens and Andy Hummel, or Big Star, the most influential band that everyone's forgotten. Well, almost. I've got Drew DeNicola, he's the director of a brand new documentary feature about the band. It's called Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me, and it premiered on the Sundance Channel on the 12th of December. One of the saddest revelations or takeaways from your movie, and there are quite a few of them, is this notion that they were a band somehow out of time, that their greatness was lost in this time when it was so much harder to connect with an audience. Would Big Star be big stars in the age of the internet, or were they just of that time and place?
Yeah, I guess they were of that I don't know. Can't believe I'm stumped on that one. I mean, I think maybe they were not of that time and place because the whole idea of, I think for two reasons, like as far as their approach is very much like today where, at least in this quote unquote independent music world, you're supposed to do it your way and not be swayed by popular tastes. And, you know, that you're not supposed to be answering to a record label. And, you know, that's still kind of the ethos of your contemporary independent rocker. But also the music itself, I think that it was very, revisionist in the way that they put their pop music together. I mean, you really do hear so many elements of things that sound kind of familiar, but sort of turned on their head a little bit or recombined in these weird ways. So that whole sort of revisionist idea of pop music was happening with them, and that's still a big element of independent music today. So I think that's why they endure. And I think that, I think time caught up with them. It's not like they were the only people that made music with those albums, but they definitely needed the late 70s to happen. They needed the punk rock explosion to happen, and they needed, sort of a new undercurrent to give them, to shine a light on them.
And I think we miss it. I think we miss that kind of band. There are so few bands these days who play to the kind of rock grandiosity of the era, right? To call yourselves Big Star, to name your first album number one record, that's something. And you just got to miss that in today's music. That's why I think I loved what U2 did with their latest album. It's so hard to be rock and roll in the 21st century, so you shove it down people's throats, right?
That was the most audacious like move you could think of, and it went down so badly.
I know.
I actually still don't know how to get it off of my iPhone. It comes on every now and then.
There's an app.
Yeah,
I think they released a tool that helps you remove the album.
That's great. Yeah, that's what we need. Yeah, U2 deletion app.
Exactly.
I'd like to delete them from my oral universe at this point. As far as the name and all of that, it was slightly tongue in cheek, and that's also why the music is interesting. Is both Chris Bell and Alex were very, very funny and kind of had a very dry wit and cynicism. And, so I think that in a way they kind of sealed their own doom because they were sort of joking about that name and about the first record's name. And even the second one, they called it Radio City because they were like, you know, it's like, this is like Radio City, man. It's like, you know, this is going to be on the radio. This is now, how could you not want to put this on the radio? It was a very, it was like, let's give them what they want. And even that didn't work, you know? And so I think that it's really hard when you are already sort of, and it's very Southern actually to sort of be anti, but also like really glad when you're noticed, you know? And that's kind of how Alex lived his whole life. I mean, to be a stalwart as an outsider, but he totally enjoyed when people took notice or cared or, like, you know, genuflected in front of him at a show, even though he, like, scoffed, you know? And I think that's also part of it, too. I don't want to paint these guys as the most pathetic guys in the world. I mean, they kind of, there was a wry wit to what they were doing, and I think they also were kind of their worst enemy. I know that Alex was, and I think that I sort of tried to show that Chris Bell, in a way, didn't learn to just sort of call it a day with a song and say, that's good enough. He just, you know, started to, you know, spend endless hours in the studio trying to perfect songs and was never satisfied. So they just were not music big guys, either one of them.
I'm speaking to Drew DiNicola. He's the director of the film Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. Here's another one of their songs, Oh My Soul. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Paganampake Pagan, and I'm speaking today to Drew DiNicola. He's a documentary filmmaker whose latest movie is about the band Big Star. So I want to ask you about the, I guess, burden of curation when making a film like this, in telling the story and selecting that music, because you're bringing the story to an entirely new generation. I mean, the number of people who bought a Yes record after Almost Famous, and don't even talk about Searching for Sugar Man, right? But yeah. What is it like in selecting the kind of music you were going to use for this film? Because Oh My Soul is a great song to start with.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing up the term burden of curation. And I've never had anyone mention that to me, but I am very proud of my job at curating this band. And you're right. On My Soul, we realized was an opener, like, way late in the editing game. But it's kind of like, yeah, I think that we just wanted something to kind of blow people away that's not one of their most famous songs. But some of the other songs in there, I'm trying to think of some of the songs that I really enjoyed using and putting in there. Daisy Glaze, I loved how we had the critics explaining how interesting that song was. I think that people overlook how interesting Big Star was in the studio and how revolutionary some of what they did was, and we actually had people explaining that a little bit. And that was the song. Remember, at some point we were like, let's let some of these songs play and not just be talked over the whole time. And it's upsetting to me. I still get criticism. They never let you hear the songs. Well, it is a movie. You have to have movement. You have to have people talking. But we, on that song and about two other songs, we put the listening time. That was one of them. We found a song by Alex Fulton that's been on some bootlegs called The Walking Dead, which is like a song that came after the third record, which is even crazier and wilder. And it's about being a zombie that feeds off of people's blood. And it's just all about how he just messed up on barbiturates and, you know, like living this vampiric life or whatever. And the song is super cool and really sounds like this proto-punk John Cale kind of thing. That's in there. I also love that we got real Sun recording songs in this movie. Sonny Burgess, the rockabilly musician, is still alive. And, you know, Rick Clark, who appears in our film, said, you know, I can talk to Sonny and he's a really nice guy. He'll probably be okay with it. And I know Sun Records. And we actually went and signed the contract at Phillips Studios where Sam Phillips had his studio and signed it with Roland James, who was Jerry Lewis's guitar player, who was still alive. He just died. That was just kind of an honor for me. And I just love that we got to put all these elements, and then we had the stacks, and we had it's impossible to get a stack song because they're owned by, like every major company has a piece of those stack songs. They're so expensive. And we found a song that was not owned. It was a Packy Axton song. It was like a one-off. It happened to be an amazing song. And we actually dealt with the family of the singer and the family of the producer, and that song made it in. So I just love that you have like this great collection of music between Big Star and Stax and rockabilly. So that curation of the music was really enjoyable. And I actually think the soundtrack that was made, I had nothing to do with it, was well done. It didn't have the non-Big Star songs on there, but they even included some of the audio recordings because we had so little material to work with. We had 20 minutes of no sync sound, 16-millimeter footage, and then we had 2 hours of the band recording in the studio on audio only.
Right.
So I spent all this time putting together little bits of conversations that would kind of come across well. And that's in the movie, and they actually extracted that and put that on the soundtrack, and it sounds great. So, yeah, that was really cool. But what you're saying about how do you decide what songs the audience should hear and in what order, I remember we talked forever about what should be the last song and the credits, and I think that Take Care was appropriate. I really do love the way all those songs come out. I think that... thinking about others now, but they're all in there in the right order, and I think that they're exposed in the right kind of way.
Because you can't afford to get that kind of thing wrong, can you? I mean, the last thing you want is people, because that first song, I mean, Oh My Soul, has such a great hook, and within those first few seconds of the film, first few minutes of the film, if someone's not hooked, they're not going to stay with you.
Yeah. Actually, interestingly, before we had that sort of the shots of Memphis and stuff, we had Jody Stevens in the studio playing drums to that song. He had them on his headphones.
Wow.
And was playing the drums. And I remember when he did that, I was getting goosebumps. And it was actually like my second day shooting in Memphis. And I was just like, oh, I cannot believe this. I cannot believe I'm making this movie. And I, because remember, I got into that band when I was 18 and had lived with that band for so long that I had actually just put them away at a corner and hadn't listened to them in years because they were in my DNA at that point. And to be there and Jody Stevens is playing that song so loud and I'm shooting him do it. The second cameraman, it was lit and it looked really good. And that was going to be the opening. It was going to be him drumming with the credits on one side. And we had one screening with it like that. But we realized that for the uninitiated, they would be, who's this guy? Who's this guy on these drums? You know, they haven't met him yet. So those are the sort of considerations that we were making all the time, you know, like, even though it's cool, you know, even though the fans will love it, we're really trying to introduce everyone to this band.
That's fantastic, Drew. I've just got one more. I'm just curious now, one more question to ask you. Just about your favorite rock documentaries. What did you grow up watching? What do you enjoy? What kind of influenced you as you were making this film?
Actually, what influenced me were not documentaries. They're mostly narrative films. I really think of, like, you know, Citizen Kane, as great a movie as it is, I just very, very purely just took the sort of element of trying to get at this person who's gone. And that's how I made the film. It's like, this band is gone. We're talking to the friends and the friends of friends and the ancillary people and putting together a very vague idea, you know, sketching in the story and sketching in the personalities, and you're never quite getting it. And I realized that there was a drama in that when you're trying to ascertain this story. And I really felt like that's the only way I wanted the story to be told, because I did not want to totally answer anything. I liked the mystic elements of this story and of this band, and I didn't really want to just give you the expose. I mean, there are books out there if you want to learn exactly what happened and who said what and who talked to over or whatever. So so the Citizen Kane was a big one, and I always thought about that, like Rosebud, and just these elements of story that I wanted to have in the movie. And I'm trying to think of other films. I would just say that one. I mean, that it's so obvious, but it's not so obvious for documentaries. And I actually feel like I always think about narrative films when I think about documentaries. I think about documentaries when I think about narrative films. Because with narrative films, you want the narrative to feel realistic. You know, you want to be able to believe it. You want to feel like this is a real person. So, you know, it's interesting how these things interchange.
That was Drew DeNicola. You can catch his very excellent film, Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me, on the Sundance Channel. That's Astro 438 for those of you who have this service. It's going to be on the 20th and 23rd of December. Now we have a little more Big Star to take us out. Here they are with 13. This has been the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.